the week of September 15th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 462, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Frankie Campbell Funeral Chapel in Manhattan, I'm Michael Giltz.
I have no idea why you're at a funeral chapel. Is it for Robert Frank, the photographer?
No, it's for MoviePass. It is officially dead.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It is. It's funny. I'm trying to write a story about it for Celluloid Junkie. I don't even know how to begin other than you probably thought this story had been written already.
That's what everybody's doing, and that works just fine.
Oh, is it? Really? I had not read anybody else's story, so maybe I won't begin it that way.
I'm lucky to be at this chapel. A friend of mine actually had his memorial service here. Judy Garland, rather famously, had her New York memorial here at the Frankie Campbell Funeral Home. And I'm lucky to be here because I was in the dunce corner, placed in the dunce corner by AutoCorrect. Thank you, AutoCorrect. Last week, I tried to champion and raise up the Crazy Rich Asians co-screenwriter Adele Lim, but AutoCorrect changed her last name to Kim. So I mispronounced it during the show. I do apologize. It is, of course, Adele Lim. Sometimes AutoCorrect, it's a name. Why would you think you knew the proper spelling of a name? You know, that just seems something they should not correct. When you cap something, they should just shut up and get out of the way.
That's okay. Every time I type the word Los Angeles, which I tend to do a lot since I live here, it just does all caps for everything.
Oh, lovely.
Los and Angeles. I'm like, what makes you think that I want that in all caps all the time? Why am I always screaming Los Angeles?
And I was poised to refer to Bruce Springsteen this week as Mr. EGOT, but that was not to be. The Creative Emmys took place over the last 2 days, and we're not going to really cover it. We'll wait for the Emmys. Those are coming on Sunday night. Those are the big awards. But Springsteen lost out. He had a chance to win as a producer for his Springsteen on Broadway Netflix special, but Norman Lear beat him. Norman Lear beat him with his producing credit on that live TV All in the Family and Jefferson special that he did with Jimmy Kimmel, making Norman Lear the oldest Emmy winner in history at 97. That's pretty awesome. And he beat out Richard Attenborough, who had been the oldest winner for about half an hour since he won earlier in that evening for narrating Our Planet, the Netflix documentary. He's 93.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Betty White said, I can beat you both.
I wonder if Springsteen, when he heard that, started singing One Step Up and Two Steps Back.
Nice. Well, you know, that's what happened. That's the award show. And someday we'll be at an award show where we win for best podcast because we cover so much stuff every week. What are we going to do this time?
Well, on this week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to ask ourselves the big question. Is it a franchise?
What's it?
Yeah, I was just going to say, please don't ask what it is, or Michael will launch into his Abbott and Costello routine again. He doesn't even need somebody to play off. He just does both sides. It's amazing.
Third base.
Exactly. In China, they're gearing up for a national day on October 1st. That means boring programming on TV, but big hits at the box office. Will those hits be Chinese or foreign? That is the question. Now, speaking of hits, Ann Thompson of IndieWire sees them all first. She'll join us to look back at the festival season and look forward to award season, which I believe ended just last week, by the way. To me, the Oscars are a joke, and Ann says this year, that could be truer than ever. On Inside Baseball, it's official. Disney wants to end the fights over profit participants on TV shows by getting rid of the back end altogether. Watching the massive paydays Friends and Seinfeld are still raking in decades later, well, that might be a hard battle for the Mouse House to win. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world, and we look at the total box office for the last 7 days. We're the only people in the world to do it. We were one of the early adopters when it came to focusing on worldwide box office instead of just North America, because it doesn't make any sense to talk about box office in New York City. You want to know what the whole country is making. Well, now you want to know what the whole world is making and what movies they're going to see. And why?
You know who else does it, by the way? You know who else does it this way? Yeah, every studio executive.
Do they?
Well, no. I mean, they do care.
They get their Monday figures with the whole all 7 day grosses in it?
No.
No, they don't. They should, because it's an important and it's interesting. We begin with a link to ComScore. We've got them in our show notes. We also pull information from Deadline Hollywood and Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, you name it. I'm pulling info from India box office websites. It's tricky, though. They're like a day or two behind, and the way the box office website I have presents their info, it's very confusing. If you've got an Indian box office website to recommend, especially one in English, let me know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
And if you didn't guess, we are not fans of Modi. Anyway, we're looking at the worldwide box office. This is for the entire week of September 15th, ending Sunday, September 15th. The number one movie around the world is It, Chapter 2. $138 million it made last week. It's at $325 million worldwide. And that prompted a couple of news stories, because the first movie made $700 million worldwide, and they all loudly announced the It franchise has now made $1 billion. Is a two-part movie a franchise?
No. I guess you could call it a franchise.
No,
because
you can't.
It's a movie with a sequel.
No, it's not a movie. It's not even a sequel. It's a two-part movie.
It's like a continuation.
Yeah, it's a movie released in two parts. It's not even a sequel. It's just a movie in two parts. Or even if it is a movie and a sequel, there's no clear third movie, so it's not a franchise.
But don't you think they're going to try and figure out how to do a third movie?
They're
going to
have
like
grandparents
that
next time? It Chapter 3? We didn't even plan that. We're so funny. All right, at number two around the world is Hustlers, the J-Lo extravaganza with Constance Wu co-starring. $37 million it made on its opening week. Good buzz from the award season. Ann Thompson will talk to us about that. It opened in North America, and I have to agree with Sperling's friends who were at, what was that event you were at? The exhibitor?
Oh, Cineshow?
Yeah, I agree with the women there. Not a good movie. Not a good movie. Boring, boring, boring. I'm shocked.
It's funny because they were all all the women that saw it, and even some of the men. I mean, but basically everybody that saw it was like, eh.
No, it's very flat and uninvolving. I'll be shocked if it has really good legs, because everybody I know who saw it was like, my brother saw it. He likes J-Lo. He goes to see J-Lo movies somehow. But he saw it and he's like, I'd give it a C, maybe a D. I mean, there needed to be a twist. Nothing happens. And you know what? He's right. But that's a solid, solid opening for a movie that just cost $20 million. And number three around the world is Detective Conan, The Fist of Blue Sapphire. This is a Japanese animation series. This is number 23 and counting. So this has been around a long time. And suddenly it's made $25 million this week. What happened? It opened in China. It's now at $114 million worldwide. Just think about that. It had made about $90 million worldwide, and now it's jumped to $115 million. It's made another $25 million, and it's still going strong. That's what happens when your movie opens up in the second biggest market in the world.
And the market with, like, basically 1.4 billion people.
Yes, there's a lot of people in China, but that doesn't make it the second biggest market. It's because of how many people go to the box office and how much money they spend. Otherwise, right, India would be number one, and China would be number one or two, and we'd be number 30. At number four around the world is, in fact, another Chinese film. It's the first on our list this week, but it's called The Last Wish. And we've been talking about it for a while. I forget what the three or four earlier titles were, but this is about a teenager who's dying from muscular dystrophy, and his dying wish is to lose his virginity. Who can blame him? And his two nutty friends try and make that happen. It finally opened up in China, and it made $23 million.
So it's basically the 17-year-old virgin.
That's right. At number five is Hobbs and Shaw, the spinoff from Fast and Furious. That made another $22 million worldwide. That's at $740 million and counting. Again, the last big push all came from China. It fell hard and fast, but it was enough to turn Hobbs and Shaw into a really iffy proposition into a modest winner. And number six is a movie I forgot to look up the pronunciation of. It's a Chinese TV show turned into a film. It's called The Legend of Hai, H-E-I. I really apologize on that one. It's an animated film, and it opened last Saturday in China, but it didn't make it onto the ComScore charts in time. We didn't get I didn't get wind of it till like Monday or Tuesday after we'd done the show, when suddenly I saw, what's this movie? It grossed $12 million. Never heard of it. Well, now it's been open one full week. It grossed $21 million this week. It's now at $33 million worldwide, all from China. And if we went back in time to last week, it should be up there on our charts, like in the top 10 somewhere. But we didn't have the info. So, you know, whenever you hear about a movie, as we've already given you the info, if you see a movie and it's not on our charts or it's slipping through the cracks, let us know so we can start tracking it.
Yes, you can write to us, No, just kidding.
At number seven is the Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Another $19 million. That's at $330 million worldwide. It's now, I think, number two of all time, looking to pass Django Unchained. And he's about another $110 million to become Quentin Tarantino's biggest movie worldwide of all time. But it's already profitable, and it's still got award season to come. That's right. We'll be talking to you, Ann Thompson. At number eight, here's a flick and a franchise. It's Bad Guys, Reign of Chaos. This is a Korean action film, and it's spun off from a TV show. It grossed $19 million on its opening week, and since we think it cost about $7 million, that is a great beginning, but I just cannot believe that this is not being picked up by Hollywood. This is just like Dirty Dozen. It's a TV show. It ran 11 episodes. It seemed to build every week in popularity. And yet this was like 5-6 years ago, and they never made another season. And it took all this time to turn it into a movie. I don't know the reason why, but it's basically about a cop who brings together a bunch of miscreants, a bunch of criminals to fight crime. You've got the gangster who's in jail, who like smashed his way to the top of the mob in record time in like a month, and now he's in jail, but he's still in charge. And you've got this baby-faced little psycho boy who looks sweet, but he's actually like a serial killer, and he's incredibly smart with technology. Well, you bring all those bad guys together, like Suicide Squad, of course, or like the Dirty Dozen if you go back in time, and you unleash them on the bad guys. Well, that's what they've done here. It's now a hit film, and I think Hollywood should be calling. At number nine is The Lion King. That made another $18 million. Right below that is Angel Has Fallen. Another $16 million for that film. And it's just about ready to triple its reported budget of $40 million. So at $113 million worldwide, that sucker is fine and something else will fall. At number 11, Before the Cops Get Me, is No Ja. That's the Chinese animated flick. Another $15 million. That's now solidly, I think, in second place all time. $715 million worldwide. That's a big, big hit. Almost all of it from China. Though it is here in the U.S. now, and I need to check it out.
I was going to go see it, but then I watched the trailer. I was like, I have no idea what is going on in this movie.
Well, you'll know what's happening in Downton Abbey. You've got the servants downstairs, the nobility upstairs, and the king is coming.
I need to watch like 12 seasons of the show before
I go
watch
it. There's a 10-minute catch you up for the entire series that you can watch online on YouTube. So it'll tell you who the people are, what's going on, what happened in the series. So if you didn't watch the show, you can catch up in 10 minutes.
This movie is going to make so much money.
Yeah, it's already opened up in the UK and some other territories. It made $11 million. That's a very solid opening. I'm looking at the opening nights on Thursday. My mom is going here in New York and even in Birmingham, Alabama, which is not a movie going town. A lot of tickets are sold. Those prime evening showings and the weekend showings in the afternoon and early evening, those are filling up fast. This movie is going to have legs. It's going to make good money. There will be a sequel. Here's my question. There was a sneak this week. You could have gone to the theater. You paid like $25 and got like a Christmas ornament, a Downton Abbey Christmas ornament, and you got to see the movie one week early. But none of that box office is reported. It's not on anywhere I can see. They had to have grossed a few million dollars. Where the heck does that money get reported and when?
Actually, I can tell you. So generally what winds up happening when they do and they being the studios and exhibitors getting together, they do a preview.
A sneak, yeah.
A sneak preview, yeah. The studio that is doing the preview will generally do one of two things. They will either put it on, they will replace one of their own showtime. So they'll have a movie in theaters already that's been released, and they'll say, okay, take that film off for the 7 o'clock Saturday showing,
right,
and put my film on, you know, put Downton Abbey on.
Right. You're taking off one Universal film for another. You're not screwing over another studio because they have agreements. Yeah.
Right. Or they will take off an older film although that generally they have to find a theater big enough for a sneak preview.
Well, they all have like 20 screens, so, you know.
Right. And so they'll take off a film that is not in its first or second or third week.
Or it's a kid's film and then the evening showing isn't as important, you know, something like that.
Right. And if it's not a kid's film, they can probably, that's been out for a while, they can probably get rid of the prime showtime. If it's an adult film, and I don't mean that in the... if it's a kind of a general audience film that would normally show at 7 o'clock, all of the grosses will go to the film that is replaced.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So if there's a Universal film last week that got an extra couple million bump in box office more than you would expect, you'd say, "Oh, I wonder why they trended up this week." The answer is Downton Abbey.
Correct. And the only reason that wouldn't happen is if you took Lion King off, because you know what? You weren't going to show that at 8 o'clock at night anyway. And so you could, you know, that was already scheduled not to play. And you put in Downton Abbey in that theater. Well, you're not going to give that money to Disney.
Well, of course not.
Right.
But why does it get reported with the film that was playing at 8 o'clock? Why isn't Disney reported as its own gross?
That's just the agreements for allowing your film to be replaced.
But then it gets added to the total box office of the movie. And when does that happen? Because they're obviously not going to pretend that didn't gross $3 million or whatever it did on Thursday night.
You know what? I don't know how that works these days. I know how it used to work. It never got reported. Weird. And so, yeah, it was always reported on the other film.
Because it was such a modest amount usually. It was just huge, but it could be now, you know.
Yes, that is correct.
Especially when you're charging $25 a pop. Well, if Saturday Night Live comes back and they're doing a spoof of Downton Abbey, it should be called Downtown Abbey, all people of color. Anyway, at number 13 is Taza, One-Eyed Jack. This is a Korean flick about poker players. Somebody loses a ton of money. He has to get back in and have one big score. So he pairs up with these other poker players and they plan an elaborate attempt to win one big jackpot, and things get very, very dangerous. You're all in on murder. I think that's the idea here. But it makes $11 million in its opening week in Korea. Good.
By the way, just before we go on, I know I'm going to get emails about this. Realize that what I just explained in regards to sneak previews is mostly in North America, the UK, possibly Australia. I couldn't tell you how it works in France or Germany.
Oh, cool. Well, maybe someone will let us know. Crawl is still crawling along. That's the alligator flick. That's at $83 million worldwide. It's opening up soon in Greece, China, Brazil, and Japan. But what I can't tell is why it grossed $9 million this week. There were no new territories listed as opening. The movies, the IMDb showed it opening up next week. I'm assuming that's not up to date and some territories opened it up this week because there's no reason why it would suddenly jump back up the charts like that.
Wait a second. I'm about to prove myself correct here. Who released Crawl, by the way?
Is that a line? It's a Crawl. Well,
I believe it's Universal.
You're right. It is. No, it's Paramount.
Oh, now, was...
so close. But I think Downton is Universal, isn't it?
It's maybe, Focus maybe, Features, isn't it?
Well, who is it internationally in North America? Maybe there's a difference.
I don't know. I thought it was Focus Features in North America.
And Focus is held by?
Universal.
Oh, well, that's what it says on the international ComScore chart. It said Universal for the international distributor. So close. Oh, well. That does not explain Crawl, but that would have been awesome. Anyway, moving along, that was a good try. Here's another bit of confusion. When you're looking at the worldwide charts and you're looking at all these movies around the world that you're not necessarily familiar with, it can get tricky sometimes. Here's Cheer Up, Mr. Lee. That's a Korean comedy from 2012. 2012 this movie came out. Did they open it up in China? I have no idea. It grossed $6 million this week. ComScore only shows it making $6 million total, but that's simply because sometimes when a movie hits a new territory, they forget about the earlier box office. Like a film from India that opens up in China, sometimes they're not including the worldwide total, they're just including this issue of the movie, and they forget to add in all the box office they made before in India and the other parts of the world. So Cheer Up, Mr. Lee made $6 million this week. It's being distributed by somebody. It hit a big territory. I'm imagining it's China, but why they picked up a movie from 2012, I don't know, except to say, you know what? They really need product. If that's the case, then they're really hurting for films if they're reaching back to 2012 to find something that they can throw up on the screen. At number 16 is Dora and the Lost City of Gold. That's about to hit $90 million worldwide. That's another film with some big territories to come. We'll have to see where she ends up. Oh, you know what? I jumped to the worldwide chart. I apologize about that. So Dora is at $90 million worldwide. The Angry Birds movie 2 is at $111 million. That is not going to be a success story. Chachori, that's an Indian drama about the losers and the dad who tells his son in college, no, we thought we were losers too, but we worked hard and we made it. That made another $6 million. It's getting great buzz. It's doing really well. It's at $15 million total. Compare that to Saho. That is a big, huge, massively expensive, elaborate Indian film that fell 85% from its opening weekend take. People hated it, apparently, but it made so much money in its first week that it's already in the top 20 all-time grossing films in India. It's at $60 million, I think. What it made actually this week, I'm not sure. It's a little tricky to tell because of those Indian charts, but I do know that Dreamgirl opened up. It's a light comedy about a guy who works on a phone service. It's not a sex line. It's a friendship line. Apparently, there's a thing where people call in. They want a friend to talk to. And he has this light little dreamy voice. And he decides to be a girl on the line. And men call in and fall in love with him and want to marry him. And it's hilarious. It's like Tootsie, but on telephone.
That's very funny, actually. The only thing they need to for the sequel is, he doesn't know like how to be a girl. So he has to get, his... somebody else, a Cyrano type thing.
That's right. That opened up pretty well. 3.6 million, not great reviews, but the audiences are enjoying it. And right below that is a movie audiences are not enjoying. It's The Goldfinch. Hustlers had a big opening and people are actually saying, hey, maybe J-Lo could win or get a Best Supporting Actress nomination. Having seen the film, I can't help thinking, no. But The Goldfinch, that was hoping to be an Oscar hopeful. It opened up very, very poorly in North America and a few other places around the world. $3.6 million, terrible reviews, very poor box office, a sad disappointment for Warner Brothers. You want them to make films for adults, and it cost $45 million to make. This is a lavish, adult film. Sometimes it just doesn't pay off, though.
Now, did you read the book? I think I may have asked you that last week.
No, I haven't read the book. I've read The Secret History, but not that one.
Okay.
It's not a dense one. It's supposed to be fun. So we'll have to see. China does have National Day coming October 1st. It's often a big holiday for movies. If they are grabbing stuff like Cheer Up, Mr. Lee, we have to wonder, are there going to be more room for North American films, for Hollywood movies to step in there and fill the breach? That may be what they're going to do. If it's a slow year at the box office. No Jaw has been a big hit, but films have been canceled left and right. They only want patriotic, TV shows airing on TV. Maybe they have the same restrictions for Chinese films. I don't know.
Well, Michael, you don't know what movies are going to open in, or even television shows are going to play in China, or movies are going to open in China, but I bet you a few of those movies down the line will have played at this year's film festivals, whether it be Toronto or Telluride or Venice. We know one person who has been to almost all of them, maybe not Venice, because of course it overlaps with Telluride, and that is Anne Thompson, who is here from IndieWire to tell us about the state of the fall festival season. Anne, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. It wouldn't be a complete fall festival season without you guys.
Darn right. And, what is the fall festival season like? You have your pulse on it. And every year, of course, it's fun to go. But what's your sense of the overall state of the fest? It seems like the same journalists are attending. It's a healthy attendance. Publicity is good. They're useful platforms. Everybody's happy. Or are they feeling a little stronger than before or a little weaker? What's your take on things?
Telluride is always Telluride is interesting because you really have to have the goods to go to Telluride. You have to be confident because the journalists there are really scrutinizing everything with a very high standard, right? Mm-hmm. So Ford versus Ferrari came out of there really well. That's a Fox Disney project with Matt Damon and Christian Bale, working for Ford. Henry Ford II, played, of course, by Tracy Letts, right? And they're going, you know, they're going to take this new souped-up sports car to Le Mans, and they're going to win against Ferrari. It's a wonderful layered character piece with a lot of great action, and James Mangold really delivers. So that went to so the whole point is to launch in Telluride or Venice or both, which is what Marriage Story did. And get a lot of buzz going, and then go to Toronto and amplify everything with the bigger media presence and all the audiences there. And so everything played out really well. I mean, Ad Astra played only Venice, so I still haven't seen it yet. That's obviously an art film with Brad Pitt in outer space, and we have to see how that, you know, is going to play for a general audience. It's sort of significant that they didn't take it to Toronto, I think. Mm-hmm. Or Telluride, you know.
Is that because they're not confident in it?
I'm not confident in it. In its commerciality. But I have to see it. I mean, I'm open. But Joker won the Golden Lion in Venice, and then goes to Toronto and just kills. But it was divisive. It was fascinating how many people got into arguments about that. And that's a good thing.
About what, though?
It has to do with whether it's a real DC, you know, comic book movie. I mean, it's a lower budget. It's like $45 million or $55, you know, in that range, $50 million range. It's a Joaquin Phoenix piece that could stand alone, apart. He doesn't have to be playing the Joker. He doesn't have to be in the Batman universe. It could stand alone as a kind of 70s dark character piece. But of course, they would never make that unless they had Joker to hang it on. That's the point, right?
The days of Taxi Driver are long gone.
Exactly. It's very much an homage to Scorsese. And it did really well in Toronto. But of course, Toronto is all about the audience award. So the movie that won that was a movie that was turned down by the New York Film Festival that maybe wasn't even submitted to Telluride and ended up getting the audience award. Jojo Rabbit, Taika Waititi's Hitler satire from Fox Searchlight. And that just raises, both Joker and Jojo Rabbit are sort of like, what's an Oscar movie now in the world of Bohemian Rhapsody? You know? I mean, you're not supposed to be at 49 or 50 on Metacritic and be an Oscar movie. And even Jojo Rabbit got very mixed reviews from the critics, and then it won the audience prize. So,
well, I think that, frankly, if it hadn't won the audience prize, I think I'd be a little concerned about the movie.
It wouldn't be an Oscar contender. It's almost like it wouldn't be one.
Yeah, because the critics were very down on it, and they felt like, you know, it's not a horrible movie, but it's not a good movie.
They seemed to think that he was doing some kind of Hitler light, right? Because it's a comedy. And there are comedies, you know, The Great Dictator and
To Be or Not to Be,
and Life is Beautiful. You know, they exist. But they're tricky.
You mean World War II comedies?
Or Holocaust comedies, Hitler comedies, movies that make fun of Hitler. Well, they're not making fun of Hitler. Right? That's the trick. And of course, YTT is not making fun of Hitler. He's absolutely concerned about where we are right now today. It's a serious movie with comedic overtones. It has a great tone. I liked the movie very much, but the critics seem to think that he skimmed the surface of this without going deeper or some such thing.
Well, you're not supposed to be a streaming movie and be up for Oscars either, but it seems like other than Cannes, all the other festivals have made their peace that streaming and even TV shows are part of the mix now. They're permanently part of the mix, and everybody's comfortable with that. They don't really question it anymore.
I would agree with you. There's several things going on. I would say that Netflix absolutely has the strongest lineup of anybody right now, I would argue. I mean, coming out of they insisted on taking Marriage. This is the policy that the strategy that they followed for Roma, which is to, given that they're not in as many theaters for as long as a lot of other movies, they're going to as many festivals all over the place. So poor Noah Baumbach and Adam Driver, you know, and Scarlett Johansson had multiple festivals. It was in Venice, it was in Telluride, and it was in Toronto, and it killed everywhere and came in second for the audience award. And I would, in Toronto, and I would suggest to you that it's actually the front runner, along with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, for multiple Oscars across the board. It could do really well.
Yeah, you said that it was between Scarlett Johansson,
it's
For Marriage Story.
It's also good in Jojo Rabbit, by the way.
Yes, but more specifically, Best Actress.
Marriage Story, yes.
For Marriage Story, which
against
is, you know.
Against Renee Zellweger, right.
Again, yes, Renee Zellweger for the Judy Garland biopic.
So Judy is the vehicle for Renee Zellweger to play Judy Garland at the end of her tragic life in London. And she kills it. She's incredible in it. And she's definitely going to get nominated and she could win. But I'm going to suggest to you that over the long haul, the movie that has better reviews and is more of an audience pleaser in the end will carry more weight than the weaker movie. Judy's a weaker movie than Marriage
Story. So hence Bohemian Rhapsody gets nominated. He may win Best Actor, but it sure as heck won't win Best Picture.
No.
Well, is there anybody questioning festivals? They don't question streaming anymore, but everybody's happy. It feels like a healthy ecosystem
it's
right
fine.
Now.
I would say to you that Telluride is healthy as ever, that Toronto is healthy as ever. I'm sure New York is going to do great. Venice is fine. No, it's not the festivals themselves that are in trouble. It's the markets that go along with them. It's
and
the ecosystem
that.
At large. The issues in Toronto had to do with all these movies that were up for sale. There were quite a few of them. Acquisition titles that didn't sell. I mean, that played well even or got good reviews even. Or there's just so many question marks. Something like Bad Education with Hugh Jackman. They're probably waiting to get the price that they want, the best price that they can get. But those prices are reduced. And the question is whether the streamers are entering the market now and competing with each other more to raise the prices. But right now, a mature streamer, if you like Netflix, they're making Dolomite Is My Name, which also played really well. They're making their own movies. They don't need to buy movies. And that's the situation. So that the hungrier streamers that are coming into the marketplace and learning the ropes that Netflix has already learned. That's what I see so clearly. Netflix has also got the best awards team and the best marketing now. They didn't a few years ago, but they do now. They've learned.
Well, they've also been faulted for spending $13 million making the movie and $50 million on the
you mean
awards
Roma.
Campaign.
You
yeah.
mean Roma. I don't
well,
know that they're...
Donald, why would you fault that?
If you can afford it. I mean, finally, Apple and Amazon and Warner, you know, Media, which has HBO Max, and of course Disney, which has Disney Plus, they have plenty of money. They're going to have lots of money to spend, and they're spending it. Whether they're making good content or not is another question. Whether they have the kind of knowledge that Netflix has about how to reach people is another matter. But festivals are super important for reaching people and building buzz, and I think this year definitely demonstrates that.
Was there any conversation about the fact that, you know, Netflix kind of came to its agreement with at least certain theaters to play the film for 4 weeks, you know, and by film, I guess we're talking about The Irishman.
There's a slate of films led
by
The Irishman. Yeah, and Marriage Story.
That they said, okay, we're going to shorten the window here. You'll have it exclusively for 4 weeks before we ever stream it on Netflix. Whereas AMC and Regal and the big movie theater chains here in North America say, well, thank you very much. We're not going to be doing that. We're not going to play that.
So the word on the street, and I've talked to people at Netflix and I've talked to people in the theaters, and I know that they were talking, and Netflix was trying really hard, almost acting like a middleman on behalf of the studios, believe it or not. Everybody thinks they're at odds with each other, but as a disruptor, as an independent agent, Netflix isn't beholden to the old rules and is definitely trying to change them. And the studios want to change them too. So there's the 90-day thing, which is not firm. That's a flexible thing. But there were conversations about 75 days, about 45 days. And I've heard different versions of who said what and which theater owners were willing to talk about what. But in the end, they could not come to terms on anything. And they're back in bed with the indies because they have to be. And that means they're leaving a lot of money on the table. And they're four-walling again, and that's too bad. It's not ideal for theatrical to go that way.
Well, certainly it means we'll never get the actual grosses.
Right. Well, you can do what we did with Roma, which is count the theater, bookings online. You can figure it out, but it's laborious. They're not going to give it to you.
Yeah, well, and that's very manual.
Yes, very analog.
But heck, if I was Netflix, I would want a 90 days in the movie theater for The Irishman, because that's a long movie, and maybe you have a shot at getting your money back, you know?
They don't look at it that way. I mean, they're much more about holding their subscribers in North America and getting more subscribers all over the world and giving them new content every month that's must-see content. That's their game.
Yeah, but $200 million to me is not a smart game to play in terms of bringing in new subscribers. I don't think, you could have two TV shows with 10 episodes each and maybe, hit a winner, whereas The Irishman is one movie, it's 3 hours, and you're not going to get a ton of people flooding in just to see one film. That's my feeling.
Well, they have a lot of stars in it, and people want to see Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and Al Pacino, and I would think that they would. I would hope so. I hope it's a good movie. That's the big question. It's opening night at the New York Film Festival, and we're going to find out.
Well, you have lots of good movies that you saw at the festivals. Obviously, Joker and Marriage Story and Ford versus Ferrari, but you had The Two Popes, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the Mr. Rogers.
They both were really good, both of those.
Bad Education.
They were better than I was expecting.
Yeah, Bad Education, The King, Knives Out, some smaller films like Uncut Gems, The Laundromat. You guys even had a great story in IndieWire saying, hey, here are some films that need distribution in North America, like Bad Education and the Helen Reddy biopic I Am Woman, and About Endlessness, the Roy Anderson film, which I'm dying to see.
Me too. I didn't get to everything. That's the other thing. I didn't even see The Laundromat or The Goldfinch, which just died at the box office. I tried to get tickets to The Goldfinch from Warner Brothers in Toronto at a public screening, and they said they didn't have any.
Oh, please. Which is their way of saying we don't want
you to see it. Right. Exactly. That's why we brought it to a film festival. We didn't bring it for the media.
Right. And the funny thing is, I saw that movie at an exhibitor trade show a week before it screened in Toronto. And they didn't say anything like, don't talk about this, don't tweet about it. They just showed the film. I think people were wondering when it was even being released, some people. Now, you mentioned, and I was reading on one of your pieces on IndieWire about J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez, and Hustlers, and whether this was her big Oscar chance, and you were kind of, maybe not. And people were giving you flack for that in the comments, but Michael agrees with you.
Well, her point was that it's supporting actress, not lead.
Yes, of course it's supporting, and it's there's a shot that she could get into supporting. There's two things. One, what did I think of the movie? I went to see the movie open mind. Totally, there had already been some hype. I had to see it. And I thought it was an okay commercial entertainment, just okay. I didn't think it was that well written or directed. I thought the characters were very shallow. And I actually didn't think the Constance Wu lead character was very interesting. I thought Jennifer Lopez ran with the ball, absolutely nailed it, did a great job. And I'm happy the movie's doing business at the box office. I want SDX to survive. It's fine. That doesn't mean it's an Oscar movie.
Not at all.
It's a Golden Globes movie. And I'm right about this. I'm right.
You're absolutely right. Plus, usually supporting actress, there's a lot of good roles that go, that go fighting for it. So if it's lead actress, some years there are hard to find.
It's actually a weak category, though, this year.
For supporting?
Because we need to see a lot of the movies. For lead. We haven't seen Little Women. We haven't seen Bombshell. Those are two of the main ones that are still to come in terms of lead actresses.
Are you excited for the awards season? I mean, we always want films made for adults to work and succeed and go at the box office. And so we're happy even to see an okay movie like Hustlers make money, because it means they'll make more of them.
Absolutely. And women I think part of what it is addressing here, I think a lot of people are responding to a movie that isn't all white people, that isn't all men. it's a very much of a female empowerment commercial entertainment, sort of like 9 to 5 or something like that. It's really or even Wolf of Wall Street, you know, kind of level of entertainment. But it's not, I don't know. I can't imagine
it's boring.
The Academy going for it. But it's great to see, you know, there's so few Latinas who've been nominated in the world of Oscars and Globes. And so I am rooting for the movie. I was rooting for Crazy Rich Asians to do well too, but that did not turn out to be an Academy movie either. It just wasn't.
You know, Hustlers, you mentioned STX is distributing the film. It was an A24 movie. So finally, the A24 has a movie that's working and it's not theirs.
Annapurna.
Sorry. You're right. I scratched that. Yes. You know, all these distributors that start with A, Annapurna. That's what I meant. Yes.
I think they dropped out of it at some point and then STX picked it up. I'm not sure about all the details, but they were in it at one point and then they let it go.
So streaming movies have won the Best Documentary Oscar. They have won Best International Film Oscar. And it's only a matter of time before they win the Best Picture. And given Netflix's lineup and the team that they have going there, this might just be their year.
What's your sense of the state of the documentary race? I mean, what are you looking at? The Cave did
The
well.
Cave. The Cave.
That's Nat Geo.
Yeah.
I mean, they do go in theaters. I mean, they have to be eligible in order to be Oscars. Mm-hmm. Most of the movies that go into... Well, Amy was an A24 movie and won the Oscar. And then James Baldwin movie was Magnolia and won the Oscar.
Yeah, we've got The Cave about Syrian doctors during the war, and we've got the Kingmaker, the Imelda Marcos documentary. It looks like that might be,
that's a Showtime
catnip
movie.
for Oscar voters.
Yeah, and I loved
Honeyland.
Those two
came out well. I love I haven't seen that yet. But I thought you were saying Honey Boy.
No, Honeyland.
Honeyland is a doc. Yes.
Yes.
Honey Boy, I liked. That's the Shia LaBeouf movie. I was finally catching up with that Sundance movie at Toronto.
And what do you think? I mean, I looked at that and went, this very well could be Shia LaBeouf's comeback.
Yes, I think
it
so.
Is already.
I mean, it's a question of who gets to see it, really. And how I thought Alma Harrell did a brilliant job with it. I thought Shia did a brilliant job with the screenplay and the performance as his father. And I thought Lucas Hedges and the little boy were both excellent. And I loved this movie. I thought it was really superb.
Yeah,
What about foreign language films or international films?
We didn't even
films?
Finish with the documentaries.
We've got
One Child Nation. We've got The Biggest Little Farm. There's a lot of the Proposal. There's a lot of interesting stuff.
The Great Hack, Edge of Democracy.
Aquarella, which I love, but I'm sure it'll be
That's not going to happen. No. American Factory,
yeah.
I think Sony Pictures Classics sort of let that slide. I don't know. They didn't market it very well. I liked Aquarella. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Amazing Grace is eligible. Apollo 11?
It's not eligible. They put it up last year, which is too bad. But Apollo 11 is for Neon. Yeah, mm-hmm. Excellent chance for that one.
There's a lot of good stuff. And Honeyland is certainly an American Factory. Both had
American
tons of
Factory,
great reviews.
For sure. Yep, yeah. I think that'll get in there. And there's a long list.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good international films, too. So it's a good award season when you can like the movies that are in the mix. You don't have to scramble to find 10 good films.
Well, a part of what goes on at Telluride in Venice and Toronto, well, especially Telluride in Toronto, is movies like The Almodovar, Pain and Glory with Antonio Banderas playing Almodovar, and then you have
Parasite
which really came in close for the Audience Award. Parasite did really well. I cannot describe to you the buzz around Parasite, how many people wanted to see that movie and how well it played for everybody. It could be a Best Picture contender, Parasite. And
well,
I
you saw
be
it
stretching.
In Cannes, right?
Yeah, I saw it after Cannes, actually.
I don't think that's a stretch at all. I think it's the.
It could be director. It could be screenplay. It could be production design. I apologize.
that yeah.
And it's never. That's him calling you to say
you're
right.
Yes, it could be. I'll say it.
I was like, thank you, Em.
Are you editing this thing? All right. I'm so sorry. It could be production design. I mean, there's so many ways that movie is a Best Picture contender.
And we know that in 2021, the personal story of David Copperfield might be a contender. It's never too soon.
They're putting that off for next year.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. For the following Oscars, right? That'll be a contender in that year.
But what do you guys think? I mean, the two movies that I find sort of hard to parse are both Joker and Jojo Rabbit, because they're so divisive. I think they're going to get into the mix. I do. I mean, Joaquin Phoenix certainly will. Yeah.
Sight unseen, it feels like Joker might be a little too harsh for the Oscar voter, but there could be that core. I think the core audience who loves it is going to certainly love it enough to get it a nomination, but putting it over the top would seem much harder.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it plays with the Academy. My instinct is that they're going to see it as a kind of 70s character movie, and they're going to respond to it very well, as if it were Taxi Driver, honestly.
Wow. Can't wait to see it.
Well, and certainly we'll be watching that over the next couple of months while you're going to... Are you going to the New York Film Festival?
Absolutely.
They didn't approve me this year, the bastards.
I'm not laughing. I'm sorry. Come.
Well, Anne, before you run off to the New York Film Festival, I appreciate you taking the time to join us here in our little sandbox to tell us all about Telluride in Toronto. At some point, you'll probably make it to Venice, but unfortunately, they keep scheduling it during all of the, you know, during Telluride.
Well, I went to Venice 1 year and went from Venice to Toronto and didn't go to Telluride. And I loved Venice, of course. But I realized how much I wanted to be part of the conversation in Telluride. And it was a lot easier to go from Telluride to Toronto than it is to go from Venice to Toronto. That's killer. That's Oof. A lot of jet lag.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for filling us in on what was going on at this year's festivals.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Well, that was awesome of Anne to join us. I'm jealous that she will be at the New York Film Festival and I won't, but we can follow her stuff on IndieWire and see what she thinks of everything.
That's true. I mean, certainly it will be that Irishman premiere is going to be, talk about tense. They've got a lot riding on that.
They want to see it. Well, they don't, because it's going to just go, I mean, even if it gets mixed reviews, people will check it out. They'll be happy to watch it on Netflix. So they don't have a lot riding because they're not trying to get big box office. That's not their plan. So I don't think it's a big deal one way or the other, whether they get great rave reviews. I'm imagining they won't, because it's been a long time since Scorsese made a great film, but we'll see.
Wait a second.
What?
You don't think it's going to be a big deal?
Did I say that?
I think somewhere in there, in that sentence, you did say big deal, which means it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Don't believe the hype.
Our first story. Okay. Now, this makes sense. Last week, we discussed the rumors about Apple TV and how much it would cost. Remember that? It was just last week. We thought $10 a month. That's what we heard. That was the rumor. That seemed crazy, by the way. Well, it was crazy, and it was also wrong. Maybe Apple played a little bait and switch, or maybe someone just got it wrong. But the official Apple announcement said their new subscription video on demand, or SVOD, as all the cool kids say, their new SVOD service launches on November 1st and would cost, drumroll please, $5 a month. Woo. Less than all the other big players.
Well, $1 a show.
Yeah, I was just going to say, although you might be able to cancel it in less than a month. And the same, by the way, is true in India. It'll cost less there, too, where it will be only $1.40 a month. That's why I'm changing my mailing address to India.
It's less compared to the other services in India.
Correct.
And their pricing. Right.
Right. Now, mind you, Michael reminded our viewers and listeners last week that we speculated Apple might not charge anything at all. Well, that was never going to happen, I said, at least. But it did, sort of. If you buy certain products, such as an Apple phone, you know, the iPhone, remember that thing? iPad or a Mac, you get Apple TV for free for 1 year. That's kind of what I said was going to happen. That would be a good idea. We also learned that Apple Arcade will be available in 150 countries, 150 countries, and feature more than 100 exclusive video games, all for $5 a month. No word yet on any bundling of all Apple services, but that's surely coming. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, it's, you know, they're entering the market. They're doing it the right way. They're going to have tens of millions of people sampling it for free over the next year, right? Anybody who buys one of their big key products is going to get Apple TV for free. And then a year from now, they'll start being automatically charged for the monthly fee of $5 a month. And maybe they won't notice it, but they're certainly going to get a lot of sampling. And that's the smart thing to do. When you only have a few shows, you should be offering it for free, because what the heck? And the bundling will be good. We'll have to see what that works out to be. But we do know that one person is not happy. He's leaving. Disney head Bob Iger resigned from the board of Apple now that they have officially announced their streaming service, which will, of course, compete directly with Disney Plus. You know what? He should never have been on the board in the first place. You're the head of Disney. How do you have times to be a proper board member overseeing another company? It's all BS where they're all on each other's boards and pay each other money and raise their salaries. It's part of the corruption of boards, which is a horrific problem in business all over the world.
Well, you know, it didn't take long, okay? Saturday Night Live named three new cast members, including its first East Asian actor.
And I guess he's gay, and he's openly gay.
They also named Shane Gillis, a rising talent whose podcast includes quite a few racial slurs and derogatory comments, including some directed at Asians.
Awkward.
Yeah, with one hand you giveth, the other hand you taketh away. One of his comments about Chinatown, what was it? The language barrier is so bad he resorts to pointing at the menu. Hilarious. Now, tell that joke in Mandarin and we'll be impressed. He scrubbed YouTube, took down some podcasts, and issued a non-apology saying, quote, "I'm a comedian who pushes boundaries. I sometimes miss. If you go through my 10 years of comedy, most of it is bad. You're going to find a lot of bad misses. I'm happy to apologize to anyone who's actually offended by anything I've said. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?"
You tell me.
Well, I think, you know, look, I get what he's trying to say by saying anyone who's actually offended.
He's saying, screw you. Nobody really cares. They're just dumb jokes. It's just comedy.
He's also saying, you know, who's really upset here is the media.
Can be upset because he's hidden everything. When you get on Saturday Night Live, people should be Googling you and seeing your clips on YouTube or listening to your podcast and going, this guy's great. No wonder he's on Saturday Night Live. I can't wait to see him. He's a rising star. Instead, he's hidden everything because he's ashamed and embarrassed of it. And if they did hear it from all the written reports of things that he said, incredibly, they're not even jokes. They're just stupid, moronic, hateful comments. Oh, let's rate women in comedy. Well, white women are the worst, so they're at the bottom. But that Asian chick is funny, so they're a little bit better. It's not even jokes. And the main point that a lot of people said is, you know what? It's not that it's offensive. It's that it's all so bad. Everything that we're like, why are you hiring this guy? This looks ridiculous. So you're ashamed. Your last year of work should be your calling card. Instead, it's a source of embarrassment. Rolling Stone immediately tracked down the big club in his hometown in Pennsylvania, like Philly, I think, where it was his stomping ground. And they said, and again, what happens? You're a comedy club. A guy from your club gets launched onto Saturday Night Live. What do you say? You normally say, yeah, we're so awesome. We're so proud of him. He's great. Can't wait to see it. You know, instead, they said, we stopped working with him like years ago because of the obnoxious, racist, and sexist comments he's made on stage and off. Like, they want nothing to do with him. And this is the guy stupid Lorne Michaels has signed on to the show. So it's not
Like he won't be there for very long.
It's not about being offended or saying, how dare he? You know what? You can make a joke about a albino, transgender, Asian, deaf person. You know, we don't care. With Tourette's syndrome. Just make it funny. You know? Yeah. And the only way it's funny is if you're not making fun of them, but you're making fun of people who are scared of them or think that's what's going to happen if you allow gay marriage, that suddenly you'll be surrounded by trannies trying to sign up for the Marines. You know, if you're punching down, it's usually not funny. And this guy just didn't even seem to be punching much at all.
Well, YouTube announced a change in its music charts. As industry folk know, but most fans don't realize, you can essentially buy views on YouTube.
Our audience has just soared to 100,000 people a week.
Yes, which it, by the way, already is, we should say. Now, you take your song and pay for it to be in a quote-unquote ad at the beginning of another clip on YouTube. As long as someone watches a certain portion of your video, that counts as a view, even though they didn't seek that song out. Pay for enough of it, and suddenly, Michael's video of him covering One-on-One by Hall & Oates has racked up 100,000 views.
It's really quite good.
Yeah, well, and that seeming popularity can draw more people to the video and make it into a real hit. It's called marketing, people, at least say the pros. And so what? Well, no more, says YouTube. If you buy views, these will not count towards your ranking on the YouTube music charts. Great, but those bought and paid for views will still show up on your video as views and thus make it seem more popular than it really is. So when I show up at your video there, the one-on-one, I'll be like, oh, wow, this is it's got a lot of views. It must be a big hit. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop because they really haven't changed anything. So, you know, they're letting people still game the system because that makes them money and they don't want to stop. So it's nice that they adjusted their chart. But in terms of letting people just buy views, you know, it's sad and misleading. I don't think it'll work too much other than as an adjunct to try and get it visible so that it can then become really big. You can't turn something into a huge hit. You can just buy a little attention. So
yeah, I guess and sometimes that's all it takes.
Exactly.
Now, the epic battle over profits from the hit TV show Bones has come to an end.
Aww.
But not before a judge blasted a culture of lies and secrecy at the now gone Fox studio, and an appeal ensured that behind the scenes talent would get at least $51 million. Now that they've settled, chances are they will get a lot more.
That's real money.
Yeah, and now studios like Disney are trying to do away with back-end deals. We'll talk about that in just a second. They'll pay more up front and never have to defend rerunning a TV show on their own cable channel or streaming service or who knows what. We're still waiting to hear how much money the top talent on Bones was able to reclaim, despite Fox insisting the 12-season hit was still basically a money loser, you know, when you do the math. But, you know, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because a lot of information came out. This wasn't a case where they stopped it from going to courts and the books getting opened up. A lot of information came out. A lot of their bad intentions and misleading comments came to light. So I think it's a good thing to wake people up and go, look, this has never stopped. It's been going on since the beginning. You think you're a profit participant? Huh. You know, wake up, because they are not there to pay you what you have earned if they can get away with it.
Well, I will never forget when both Friends and Seinfeld went into syndication and how much money those shows made in syndication and how basically it allowed Jerry Seinfeld to never work again if he wanted to. But that actually brings us to our Inside Baseball segment for this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
That's right, and Jerry Seinfeld is even richer.
That's right.
Netflix has landed the worldwide rights to Seinfeld. Amazon owned Seinfeld internationally. Hulu owned Seinfeld for North America. They were paying about $160 million a year for domestic alone. $160 million a year. The show came out like 30 years ago, and they are still paying big, big bucks for Seinfeld. Now, Netflix has signed Seinfeld, and yes, they lost Friends in the Office, but they definitely have another binge-worthy sitcom, one of the all-time big ones. They own it worldwide starting in 2021. How much did they pay for it? No idea, but I'm guessing at least $300 million a year. Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
And in that light, Disney's saying, oh, you don't care about the back end. We'll pay you more up front.
Yeah,
are you going to pay me $300 million up front? I don't think so.
Yeah, which is why I think, you know, look, Disney can probably do this because people will want to work.
So okay? What are they trying to do?
Well, okay, so the Disney company, of course, you know, they own Fox now. We all know that, right?
Well, Fox doesn't exist, really.
Yeah, right. Fox being one of the largest broadcasters and television production companies. Thus, now Disney is one of the largest broadcasters and television production companies. They own ABC. They own ESPN. Bottom line is, they would like to pay you a lot of money, Michael, up front to be in one of their shows or to be one of the profit participants or creators of one of their shows. They'll pay you all that money up front. But the back end, like when they sell it to Netflix, which, by the way, they wouldn't do now. They would sell it to themselves. They don't want you participating in that at all.
Right. We talked about this a few weeks ago, but now some contracts, some actual official contracts that Disney has proposed have been leaked out, and we now know it's really happening. The major studios, not just Disney, would like to end the back end. Why? Because they are doing self-dealing, and they don't want to have to fight about it. They want to say, all right, I've got this hit show. I want to put it on Disney Plus, or I want to put it on the cable channel that I own, and rather having to jump through hoops explaining to you that they have gotten the best value for that show, they want to just end that argument. The problem is, of course, people can't imagine that it's going to benefit them financially. It's not like they're going to get more money. You have to feel, unless you're a huge, big star already, there's no way you're going to get that jackpot win, which is, you know, one in a million. You know, how often you get Friends or Seinfeld or The Big Bang Theory. It doesn't happen a lot. So they're thinking, you know what? If I have that one big payday, I'm not going to score the way I would. So no. Disney has to somehow make you feel you're going to do a lot better up front, since most shows don't go that far.
And we're talking about creators and profit participants here, okay? Right. And you'll understand what I mean, why I pointed that out in a moment.
Okay.
The way Netflix and Amazon work, Amazon basically says, you know, they all have their own deals. They award profit participation by the third season. If a show, you know, that they have created,
there is no back end. They just say, look, we show it worldwide, so we're going to pay you money up front. You get to make your show, we get to air it, and there's no syndication, there's no selling it to TV stations, there's no aftermarket for this stuff. So whatever we pay you, that's what you get. Since there's no back end, we know we got to pay you a little more up front, but there's no, you know, pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You cannot hope for that 100, you know, used to be 100 episodes. You could syndicate it and strip it and you were going to become rich forever. That ends because we don't do that. We don't play that game. So we got to pay you more up front. The question is Disney never going to syndicate anything ever again? It's all going to go straight to Disney. They're never going to sell a show into syndication. They're never going to sell it into other markets internationally. It's only
What they want to do, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, is give it to Disney Plus. And as you said, they don't want to have to explain creators.
But hey, surely to have a show on Disney, the Disney Channel, like All That or Andy Mac or whatever, and it's a hit, don't they ever think, I want to have this strip somewhere all over the world? Doesn't that ever benefit them? Do they never want to have anything anywhere else other than Disney Plus? I can't imagine.
Well, there are answers for that, much like Amazon does their whole thing. Their deal structure is you're incentivized to actually make it a hit into the third season, right? I mean, that's
right.
That's
but Amazon has no other market that it sells to.
Correct. Disney will actually be doing that. They will actually be stripping the shows if they can in future years, and they actually do talk about that in their deals. However, they really don't want to be paying for that.
Stripping on their own cable channel, you mean, or something?
Or stripping internationally or on something that isn't there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So here's my problem with this. Canceling shows after their third season because they don't want to go up to that next level of payment. They have this sort of built-in thing where they say, okay, if we go for four seasons, then you get a big bump in pay because this is that type of hit. They're sort of doing the equivalent of like first dollar participation, where if a movie grosses, say, $200 million worldwide, you get a pay bump. Right, they're doing that by saying if we go four seasons, you're going to all get a pay bump. You know, Disney may do the same thing, but the problem is they may cancel a show like The Office, which was pretty marginal for most of its run. It's ending up becoming one of the most valuable properties that you can have. But when it was airing on NBC, this was not a big hit TV show. This wasn't Seinfeld or Friends.
I remember in its second season, people were like, what? That's still when they did the upfronts, and they say, you're renewing that show? And the head of the network said, listen, just give it time. It will be a hit.
And
trust
it was never
me.
That big a hit. It was one season where it reached number 11. That was like season 7 or something. But most of the time, it was out of the top 20 or top 30. So it was never a big hit. And if they see these barriers and go, oh, after season 3, well, we got 40 episodes of The Office. Let's just cancel it now. They may end up hurting themselves because of those artificial barriers they're creating. They're saying, three seasons is enough. I also think...
Well, previously, the market was what determined the value.
Right.
For instance, we talked about Seinfeld, okay? And then when there
was
all this
slow burn too.
When there was all this self-dealing, then the market was kind of tilted and was, you know, it wasn't actually accurate. Thus, you have the Bones lawsuit, which is what Disney is trying to avoid. Now, Disney is saying in their contracts, they're going to determine the value of each show based on the deals that they've struck in the past couple of years. And then they have all of these qualifiers. And if you get an Emmy or a Golden Globe nomination or this or that, or everything is pre-negotiated. Everything. Mm-hmm. Now, you would think, like, okay, a Jerry Seinfeld, let's just take that. He's not doing this anymore. But, you know, a Judith Light or, you know, a Jerry Seinfeld, that they would be able to be profit participants in some of these shows. And basically, agents are saying that people's deals are either, you either get the Netflix deal, the Amazon deal, or what is now becoming the Disney deal.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with Disney is that, unlike Netflix and Amazon, Disney is a traditional broadcaster.
Right.
They actually do have places.
They do have back ends.
Right. Whereas Netflix and Amazon, everybody kind of had to take whatever they were giving because there was no model for it before. They were creating the model as they went along.
And they were never going to resell it anywhere else.
Correct.
Whereas Disney
could. That was not happening.
And Seinfeld, by the way, it was the fourth season before it broke into the top 40. You know, you had 40 episodes done in the first three seasons, and you might have said, it's number 42. Maybe I won't bother. You know?
Yeah. Now, you might be wondering, like, well, so, you know, all the actors are in the, and then
what do they have to gain by doing this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a big difference between profit participation, i.e., Jerry Seinfeld, mm-hmm. and residuals. And by residuals, think about it if you're like one of the bit players.
Well, you still get a residual payment, right? That doesn't end. If it gets played on cable or syndicated, whatever, then you still get residuals.
That's what the unions and guilds are afraid of, is that, well, if you're doing away with the back end for profit participants, it won't be long before you want to do the same thing for residuals, because that'll just make the accounting much easier for you entirely. You just pay everybody once, a huge upfront fee, yes, but then you don't have to, you know, go back and pay everybody again and again and again every time every year that you have the show on Disney Plus.
Right. Well, here's my problem. I think it's great that you don't have to worry about being a net profit participant for like a big movie, or argue over when a movie is profitable and now they've made money. Nowadays, all they do is say, look, you've made $300 million worldwide. I get this extra money. You make $500 million worldwide. I get this extra amount of money. And that makes sense. But there's no equivalent of that sort of nonpartisan, clear money making metric to be had when you're talking about a TV show. It doesn't exist. You cannot easily measure, especially if you're putting it on the Disney cable channel or Disney Plus and not selling it. Even if, at least if you sell into syndication, you could argue over the numbers. But they don't like to talk about the numbers. They don't like to talk about how much their TV shows are making internationally. The Good Doctor apparently is the most watched TV show in the world. That's what CBS claimed in an ad. And I thought, how many countries is it playing in? Is it really bigger than and Law and Order and the NCIS or whatever might be the other biggest show, I thought, or Game of Thrones? That's interesting. I'd like to see more money if I'm, you know, one of the stars of the show, like Freddie Highmore. So they don't talk about that stuff. There's no way to measure it. So it's sort of a black hole. You sort of have to
who do you think is signing on to these deals? Like, if you had to take a wild guess.
Well, new people who have no choice. They want to make a show. Just think you're happy to do it for Netflix because it's 8 episodes and you have more creative control. You see a reason to do it. Here, it's harder to see a compelling reason. But what choice do you have? They're one of the and as soon as you say yes to Disney, everyone else is going to ask for the same thing.
And so, and that's really what I mean. Disney is kind of the icebreaker here, mm-hmm. Going out there and trying to break these types of profit participation deals. And once they're broken by Disney, everybody will follow suit.
Yeah,
Sony Pictures and Paramount and anybody that's a television production company will do the same exact
thing. I empathize with them not wanting to argue and fight over getting the full value for a show they are self-dealing, putting on their cable channel, putting on their streaming service. But there's no way to see this as anything other than the creative people are going to hit the jackpot and make a lot less money than they would have in the old days.
Yeah, there will be two layers of people. And by the way, they say that that's already the case because effectively you've got like Ryan Murphy making $300 million on his Netflix deal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In other words, they're getting that money now. Okay. So they don't have to wait for it to be a hit. They're getting it anyway. There will be the Shonda Rhimes of the world and the younger writers and younger creators who will not be making as much money and won't be able to.
And the studios will say, well, on your second hit show, then you get to bet. You know what? Most people are lucky to have one hit show.
Right, exactly. And now it's just kind of like I noticed there was about to be a grocery store worker strike here in California. Well, the last time there was a grocery worker strike, what everybody agreed to was that the existing employees would get certain benefits and pay raises and health care, etc., but that anybody that was hired from then on would not. So they created this two-tier system of the haves and have-nots within their own union. That's effectively what they're doing here, is the people that are kind of, they've made it already. Well, you're going to be able to make these big front ends, and everybody else, we'll tell you how much you can make. So profit participation is slowly dying.
That's a sad day.
That was my segue, not sad day, but segue into our obituary section.
That's right. You know, sometimes we struggle to think of something useful to say. You know, as always, significant, important people die, but we don't always have a story to tell. The rocker Eddie Money of Baby Hold On and Be My Baby, Take Me Home Tonight, that song that he did with Ronnie Spector, gave her a big comeback single. He died this week. Robert Frank, who you referenced at the top of the show, his collection, The Americans, not the TV show, but the photography exhibit, is one of the great exhibits of all time. He's a great, great photographer. Peter Nichols, the playwright, A Day in the Death of Joe Egg. Never saw it, never saw any of his plays, but he is still a name that for a brief period was a really big deal, especially in the UK. He died, but the one that a lot of people talk about, not quite sure why this person lands, but that person didn't. It's Rick Ocasek of the Cars. He died at 75 years of age. We're not quite sure how or why yet, though no foul play is expected. They have a great, great debut album, and their 1985 greatest hit set. You got that. You got everything you need. He's a producer after the Cars broke up. He did Weezer's Blue album and their Green album and a lot of other cool stuff, along with No Doubt and people. So he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and now he's gone.
You know, I saw a little documentary or, you know, little clip of Eddie Money, and he was sitting down for an interview recently, in fact, on a TV show that he was doing. And he said, he introduced himself as, I'm the musician and singer, Eddie Money. Your mother's a big fan of mine.
Yeah, no, he was a good interview, a good self-deprecating guy who gave wry commentary on the industry. So he had a second life talking to reporters and people with no holds barred. You know, he was good. And Rick Ocasek was probably the least likely video star. You know, you think, oh, video, it's only going to be little pretty boys and attractive women who become stars. You know what? Rick Ocasek and other people, they did really innovative music videos. And that really helped the Cars, along with the fact that they had great, great music. But that was a sort of an odd fact. That was the era where videos really could make you, and they made the most of it. And if you have not heard them, check out their debut album or that 1985 greatest hit set. It matters which one you listen to. That 1985 one is online streaming, and it's really great.
Well, and hopefully you'll check us out each and every week. And if you don't want to miss an episode, subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And before Michael asks, yes, Spotify, I had to resubmit our feed because they wanted a different feed. So I gave them a new feed. So hopefully this week we will be on there.
Will there be an episode next week?
There will be an episode next week.
Sweet.
Yes.
All right.
And subscribe to us, and you'll get it automatically in your podcast aggregator or whatever you listen to podcasts on. In fact, you can rate and review our show on any one of those aggregators. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you do. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, including all of the stories Ann Thompson wrote about Telluride in Toronto and her Twitter handle. Will all be on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to call us, 888-567-SAN. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/. Yes, that's the Facebook for chickens. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Yeah, exactly. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Rick Ocasek's Dead, Who's Gonna Drive Me Home.com.
Ooh, because of course he's the lead singer of the Cars. I get it. Also the song, I know, before you correct
me. Which Benjamin Orr sang, the bassist, but yeah. One of my favorite songs of theirs.
Well, you know, that said, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. You can find some of my work on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.